from LPM.
Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.
From Louisville Public Media.
Support for this podcast comes from KTC Building, seamlessly blending the classic character of older structures with 21st century amenities and technologies. Residential and commercial remodeling projects of any size. Details at KyleThompsonCompany.com.
Hi, I'm Kyla.
And this is Jay.
And you're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Welcome back to listeners. So, Doc, you know that one of my biggest accomplishments, my biggest pride and joy is being Uncle Jay.
Yes.
You know, I really love spending time with my niece, some of that few.
And I was just thinking the other day, I was like, how come you don't post more pics with your niece and nephew? Because you're always with them.
I'm always with them.
You're always taking them places.
I am.
And doing activities.
So, Anderson and I went to the library yesterday. They had a Monster Mash dance hour.
Oh.
So, we went to, so Stu, his mother worked from home. So when she works from home, because he's obviously at a daycare right now, he's really distracts her. So I pick him up, we go to the library. They have their playing like different games, singing songs. They have fruit snacks and juice boxes and goldfish. And I really was a doting uncle. But the reason I don't is because I'm so in the moment. Believe it or not, I just don't.
You're having fun.
Yeah,
in
I'm
the
having
moment.
Fun.
Yeah.
So yeah, I love being Uncle Jay. So put that on the left side. On the right side, in pop culture, we have the movement of the aunties, right? We have Auntie Maxine, right?
Yes. And,
you know, with Maxine Waters, the legislator, has been making headlines the last couple of years. We had the Black Panther movie with old boys like, what's up, auntie? You know, like, so there's really like auntie culture, aunt culture is really alive and well in pop culture, but it's always been a thing for Black folk, right?
Yes.
So to discuss, the article is really about aunts, but I'm going to insert uncles and gunkles, like myself, into this conversation. The article was called, "They May Not Get a Holiday, But Aunts Are the Backbone of the Black Community." So please welcome, dear listeners, news producer and staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer, Brandon T. Harden. Brandon, how are you?
I'm well. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, thanks for being with us. So, that's my setup for why I really appreciated your piece. But it wasn't just because it reaffirmed my own importance to my family, but it drove home something that we've always known. And some of us always know, and some of us are discovering, is that aunts, and those can be real aunts, but usually they're play aunts, godmothers, other mothers, are really, really important to Black folk, and they've been around for a very long time. What led you to write this article, and what are some of the cool things you discovered over the course of writing it? Then we'll talk some more about what you covered.
Sure. So what made me really write the article is because I have three aunts who played a very integral role in raising me. So I thought it would be a good idea to kind of like to talk about why aunts mean so much to not just me, but to other people in the community as well. So I was just inspired through my own experience. So I brought it up to my editor. And after a discussion, we decided to move forward with the piece. And I learned that everybody has the same experience, which I thought was interesting because we don't talk about it really a lot. And a part of my job is to kind of amplify marginalized voices. So in my eyes, in my view, I felt that the auntie point of view was extremely overlooked. So like, yes, there's this like resurgence of the term auntie. And yes, we are kind of now starting to celebrate it. But for so long, aunts just kind of stood in the background of families and kind of just held everybody together. So I wanted to, for Mother's Day, I wanted to not only celebrate the mothers that do an awesome job day in and day out, but I wanted to celebrate the aunts that stood behind the mothers. So we all have been babysat by our aunt. We all have been, you know, gifted by our aunts and looked out. And I think that's usually because your aunt walks this precipice of like friend and authoritative figure. So your aunt is probably less strict than your mom, but she's probably like more official than say like your friend or your peer. So I thought that was a really interesting angle to kind of examine and report out. And it was a blast to do. I just love hearing people talk about what their aunts mean to them. And I found some incredible people like Amber Burns, who I mentioned in the story, who actually led with, she was, her and her mom didn't have a great relationship growing up. And so her aunt really stood in for those moments where you would really call your mom. So
Yes, yes. And I mean, I loved reading all the stories and all the people you talked to about how much they love their aunties and how much their aunties have really stepped up and stepped in to help bring them to adulthood and so on and so forth. And in your piece, you mentioned how the Black aunt doesn't necessarily have to be a biological relation. Explain that to our audience. Why can the auntie be someone who's not directly blood related?
Well, it comes from the mentality of it takes a village to raise a child, right? So in that, the village may not be just like your biological family. The village may be the neighborhood or the school or the church, just some part of your community where there is like attention to kind of like youth development. So I think that it's important to understand like how large the scope is for aunts and also for godmothers. And in our community, in the Black community, we have play cousins, we have play sisters, we have play brothers, we have play everybody. And aunts aren't excluded from that. I'll speak for me. I didn't even realize that one of my aunts wasn't related to me. Until I got well into my teenage years.
Yeah, exactly.
So I thought that that was an interesting topic to kind of like turn over on its head and really examine it. But I think it's all about the relationship. I think that we have so many struggles in our own community that are unique to our community, whether it's like mass incarceration or whether it was drugs in the 1980s. I think there's always been something that disrupted the family patterns and helped to like develop our youth. So in our case, it's always someone else. And usually that figure is a mother because women can be really, really nurturing. And there are uncles, too, who do a fantastic job. But for aunts, it's something about that feeling of feeling like this is someone that I can like look up to in the same way that I will look up to my mother. So that other mother term that's mentioned in the article by Kamika Williams Witherspoon was really important to me. And I thought that it was great to try to figure out why. So to answer your question, I think it's just because of our circumstances that have kind of interrupted the family development, the Black family foundation for so long. So we've had to kind of like make use of other people that are in the communities to help us out to raise our children. And I think that relationship is established well until adulthood, right? So even now, I mean, I have aunts that aren't really my like biological aunts, but I don't see them as anything less just because it's that relationship. I know that this person may not be my mom's sister, but this person picked me up from school every day, or this person, you know, was the only person to get me a gift for my birthday that year, or this person took me to the zoo when I really needed it. You know what I mean? Mm-hmm. So it's just like that relationship that you have with someone that's a few generations or a generation older than you.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I love how you mentioned that other cultures may have something similar to what Dr. Patricia O'Collins calls other mothers, but that really the notion of an auntie, you really don't get it unless you're Black. Like, you just don't understand it.
No.
Are we for real? We have an aunt. And like, Wanda is my mother's best friend from like childhood. But don't dare say you ain't my real auntie. Don't dare operate as if she can't correct me, punish me, love on me. In the way that even I'm closer to her than some of my biological aunts. And that's a very real thing.
Right.
I do want to know from you, though, Brandon, was there a definitive answer? Is an aunt, auntie, you know, you got aunt, aunt, auntie.
Well, my wife's family, they all say auntie. And the Jacksons, because their family is so large, you know, that's why I really loved your piece, too, because it just reminded me of how. I'll say, well, isn't that your niece? And she's like, well, it's not really my niece. It's my second cousin, but I'm basically the auntie.
Right. You know, if you're older, you got to be aunt.
So they don't even do, like, hey, second cousin, or, you know, anything like that. It's just, no, you're an older. You're an older, so you're an aunt figure, and they just say auntie, hey auntie, regardless of what the actual.
And
they be like auntie Kyla, you know.
You call your people what? You call them aunt? What do you call?
I call them aunt.
Aunt as well. Brandon, what do you call your phone?
Say aunt. Okay. I'm not sure. I think it might be regional or it might be cultural. I'm not really sure, but I've heard both. I've heard auntie and I've heard aunt. I usually go with the aunt, though.
It's so sophisticated. At least. But Brandon, how does one become?
I take that back. If I can really quick correct myself, I take that back because I have an Aunt Jean, and that's how we say it. She is my real aunt. So she's my grandfather's sister, and we call her Aunt Jean. And I'm from Houston originally, so I don't know if that matters.
It probably matters what goes well with their name, like Aunt Jean goes well.
Exactly.
Aunt Emily. Yes, exactly. So great. But I wanted to ask you, how does one know? that they've arrived at auntiness, right? That, you know, there's a certain, you know, there's no particular designation, but what does it take to be an auntie? Because you mentioned that mothers are usually grooming somebody, right? Or sort of like a godmother, they're kind of like people like, who can handle my kids if I'm not around, right? So how does one know, and what values must one possess to be that aunt figure for people in their lives?
Well, I think that aunties have to reach an age of maturity, and they have to have some type of, they have to prove their value to the family and to the unit. And so I think that a lot of the times aunts are groomed from a very young age. Sometimes mothers see that this child has a particular nurturing nature, and they will groom them, and they will make, you know, they will start at a young age. I know that for me, one of my aunts is, I believe she's 33 or 34, and I'm 28. But we grew up, and she looked after me a lot. You know what I mean? She's my dad's sister, and she really, really looked after me. But she was responsible. You know, she, from a very young age, she was 13. She was 14 when she learned how to drive. She was trusted to pick me up from school. She was trusted to take me places and look after me. So I think it's who the family sees as responsible, and also it's what relationship the aunt has to the mother or to the other family members. So an aunt is, anytime you say aunt something, that's a term of endearment, or that's a term of honor, right? So we won't really give that title to someone who is, you know, to be kind of like walking straight there, somebody that we don't really trust. You know, that's cousin.
Yeah,
you know,
there you go.
That's your cousin. But your auntie is somebody that, you know, your mom will, she can go and have a peaceful time wherever she is. She knows that someone trusts you. So I think it's a matter of trust.
Yeah.
And I also think it's a matter of proving value to the family beforehand. And sometimes that happens at different ages for different people. But mostly in my family, all of the aunts are older than me. I don't have an aunt that's like my age or younger. So
no,
it really just depends on the family and on the trials of that family.
So I know that you talk to a number of folks about their relationships with their aunt. Can you share with our listeners one of the most impactful stories to you, one that brought up emotion, or one that was similar to your own experience with your aunt, or just one that stood out?
For sure. So Chad Lassiter, who is fantastic, he works at UPenn here, or he went to UPenn, and he talked about his Aunt Peaches. And the way that he talked about her, the reverence that he gave her was so powerful that I could feel his love through the phone. And how he said that he grew up, it's in the article, but just to kind of go over again, he said he grew up and people would tease him about the way he looked, how he was tall, he was dark skinned, and his aunt would say, baby, don't worry about them, you know, you're going to be fine. And it's like those small moments that matter the most. And that's what he told me. And I know that to be true, because as a child, I was also picked on for being Black, for being gay, for just being different. And I had my three aunts that I mentioned at the beginning of this conversation, all three of them were there to support me in a way that my parents just couldn't. I don't know why. And sometimes they said the same exact thing that my parents said, but for whatever reason, I could hear my aunts when they said it. And I think that has to do with trust. So your parents always tell you, you know, I have your best interest at heart, but sometimes it doesn't feel that way. But it always feels that way when my aunts tell me something. And because I just think that they don't have anything to gain. They're not trying to control me. They're not trying to influence me. They just want what's best for me. And so when he was talking to me about Aunt Peaches, I felt like Aunt Peaches was also my aunt. And I have another example from the article as well, Aunt Bev. So Aunt Bev is a school teacher, and she's taught for dozens of years. And she says that, you know, the children at the school call her Aunt Bev because they trust her. They trust her to do right by them. They trust her also to be fair. And I know that to be true because my aunts don't always tell me what I want to hear, but they tell me what I need to hear. And again, it's in that special auntie way that's so hard to put in words. It's really, really difficult to try to convey what that means to people. So there were so many different instances where people just kind of said things that I was like, yep, that's in my family too. Yep, that's in my family too. So I knew that this was something that impacted everybody. And I think that was, you know, one of the biggest reasons why this article was so compelling is because people could see themselves in it. And people could say, you know, Aunt Bev is just like my aunt, or like, I'm just like Aunt Bev. I have nieces and nephews. Or Aunt Peaches, you know, we all have an Aunt Peaches. We all have a older figure, an older matriarch in our family who's going to love you no matter what you look like, no matter how big you get, no matter how much weight you gain, no matter how much money you make. Aunt Peaches is always going to be there for you. She'll likely have a plate, and she'll likely make you take stuff when you leave her house. You know, we always have that figure in our family. So, yeah, it was incredible talking to everybody and hearing their experiences.
Well, I'll tell you what, we really, really enjoyed it. I mean, it brought a smile to my face. You know, it made me think of the people in my life that I love and who have helped raise and rear me. And I love the way that you end your piece with a quote from Lasseter. And he talking about the reverence and the importance of the aunt figure, whether it be Maxine Waters or Angela Davis or Dr. Angelou. But he says, the black aunt sticks too. She gets with. She watches over. She stands in truth. Mm-hmm. She tells an unbridled truth. She's not going to hold back. And she should be held in the same high regard as your mother. And so I really, really thought that was really powerful. And so we really have enjoyed talking to you, Brandon. Again, listeners, this has been Brandon T. Harding, a news producer and staff writer for the Philadelphia Inquirer. Check him out. What's your Twitter handle, by the way?
My Twitter handle is Brandon Trevion. That's BRANDONTREVION.
All right, y'all. Also check him out at Inquirer.com. Brandon, thanks so much for being with us, and please take care, okay?
Thanks, Brandon.
Thanks for having me. Of course.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
All right, Doc, let's take a quick break. Tell the people who we are.
You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast. To support the work we do on Strange Fruit, visit donate.strangefruitpod.org or look in our show notes for a link. Welcome back. You're listening to Strange Fruit Podcast.
Doc, so it is. Let me tell you, it is tough times in governments all across this nation. Mm. I mean, you've been aware that in Louisville, for example, because of the mayor's budget,
yes,
they've had to close the public swimming pools.
Yeah,
right. So there's like four or five public swimming pools that kids can go to for like $2 or $3. You know, you went when you first got here. We went. Like,
I did, but
we
I was
like,
I
have one back.
But, yeah, I was like, never again.
Yeah,
but
yeah, you know, but they're important, right? And
yes.
So
they're necessary.
They're very necessary,
yes,
right? Especially considering the black kids don't know how to swim as well as you know. So that's another issue. But so the pools are not opening this summer. Also, they have now reduced the hours of some of the public libraries, and they've closed two branches, right?
Oh, my goodness,
so
yes,
they're talking about maybe eliminating Sunday hours or alternating weekends. And so there's all kinds of ways in which the city's trying to figure out, our city in particular, to figure out how to balance the budget. But unfortunately, to me, it's a lot of really necessary services that are having to bite the bullet, i.e. swimming pools, i.e. public libraries. And so that's why it was really cool when I came across this story on the NewYorkTimes.com that another segment of, I guess, public service that is also feeling this budget crunch in cities all around the nation are legal aid workers. And so this article, NewYorkTimes.com, is called Lawyers by Day, Uber Drivers and Bartenders by Night. So to discuss legal aid workers and why they're having to take two or three jobs, please welcome freelance writer Sonia Weiser. Sonia, how are you?
Hey, thanks so much for having me.
Absolutely. So it's not just Louisville. I guess cities across the nation are feeling budget crunches, and I never think of legal aid as being a part of that. So talk to our listeners about legal aid. What is the organization, and then how are they funded usually? Are they a government entity?
So legal aid is contracted by the government. So part of the city budget ends up going to them, but it's not
a government agency, so they're subsidized. So they're probably to me like public broadcasting
or independent contractors.
Yeah,
of
so
the state
public
government,
broadcast like KET maybe, or PBS is its own independent organization, but the government sees a value in that service, and so the government, as part of its regular budget process, will subsidize or supplement their income. Is that sort of how that works?
Yeah, so they're contracted. They're obligated to fund them, even though they
okay,
might not want to.
Okay, I love that. And so in your story, you talk about a couple of different folk there in New York City who are public defenders who you would think, I mean, lawyers, you know, they make pretty good money. I mean, we would presume that. But some of the folks in your story having to take on a number of different jobs. In your story, we meet a woman named Danielle. Talk to us a bit about Danielle.
So Danielle's a great example of this problem. She is the primary wage owner for her home. She's a younger attorneys, so she's not making as much money as some of the older attorneys, even though they're not making much money either. And she has an incredible amount of debt from her schooling. She has, she said at a time, it'll be like 3 to 4 jobs on top of a full-time legal aid job. So she'll be doing either tax assistance, helping during tax season, helping people with their taxes. She drives for different food delivery services, which also don't pay well. She'll grade essays. So she's doing roughly 22 to 30 hours on top of her full-time job just to make ends meet.
Wow.
And it's not like she has excess money or anything. Like she said in the story, anything can set her back.
Yeah.
Which is really scary.
Yeah, like her story was really, really, really disturbing. Now, how does it work, Sonia, in terms of them working multiple jobs? Like a lot of the folks in your story were Uber drivers or doing other side jobs. How is that not a conflictual thing when it comes to their positions in legal aid? Like, for instance, what I'm hinting at is I work at the university, and even if I wanted or desired to supplement my income with getting a part-time job or another job, I wouldn't be able to. It would be seen as a conflict of interest. I'm not allowed to do that. Is it the same for legal aid? I mean, it seems as if from your article, obviously not. They're able to work these kind of side hustle jobs. But does it ever, in your interviews, did you ever come across anyone where that did represent a conflict, like where they were more fatigued or their employer was like, quit your job?
Yeah, I would think like, even further, even if it's not a technical conflict, that at the very least, it attracts the time they can spend on their cases.
Yes.
So do they feel like their primary clients suffer because they're moonlighting an initial 20 hours? How does that affect their 9-to-5?
So going back to the initial part of that question, they're not allowed to do any kind of legal assistance work.
Other than
that, it's pretty much fair game. But yeah, that is one aspect that they're not allowed to do, which again sucks because that's what they have training in. So the fact that they can't use all of the education they've gotten so far to do additional labor, I mean, could be unfortunate or may not be. I'm not entirely sure whether they would want to be doing that. And then when I was talking to people, they said that it wasn't that one case or two cases were severely impacted because they were tired, but just the overall effort that they can put into their caseload as a whole, like they're exhausted and they're showing up as best as they can and they're presenting as best as they can. But I mean, it takes a toll on you, and the amount of emotional labor they do at their jobs and when they get home taking care of their families. I mean, you can imagine just the amount of stress that's weighing on you if you have no time to refresh on the weekends. Your work is going to suffer.
In addition to them having to work additional jobs to supplement their income and their general fatigue, aren't legal aid attorneys also bombarded with like a huge caseload as well?
Yeah, so one of the women I talked to, Julia, she does mostly misdemeanors, she does entirely misdemeanors. But she has like 90 something cases right now.
Wow.
So that's a lot to be thinking about. That's just a lot to be juggling.
Yeah. And so it's like a lot of these attorneys, people can say, well, why don't you go get a different job, right? But a lot of these attorneys want particularly to be in legal aid to help people who are poor, who are probably desperate, folk who are without resources. And so by comparison, for the Legal Aid Society, once you're a law school graduate, you start off in legal aid making $53,000 a year. Once you pass the bar, you can make $62,000. By comparison, folks who work for a private law firm at the same amount of time, the first year they're making $135,000.
Yeah.
So, you know, there are people, in fact, so $135,000 for a first year in a private law firm, but you spotlight a gentleman named Mr. Wasserman, who's been a legal aide for almost 35 years, who doesn't even make that much money. Talk to us a bit about who Stephen Wasserman is and what his journey has been.
So first off, there's actually a lot of first-year associates who are making $190,000 a year.
Wow, in private law firms.
Yeah, so $135,000 is the average.
Wow, okay.
But $190,000 is standard.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, which is a lot of money. And Steve Wasserman, he's been there for nearly 40 years at Legal Aid, and he makes $119,000. And his salary actually topped out after he was there for 35 years. So no matter how much longer he works there, he's not going to be getting any bonuses. He's not going to be getting any raises unless in part of their negotiation for pay parity, bonuses become an option. And I mean, who knows if that'll happen while he's still working there, because he did say he might retire in a few years. Yeah. But
what seems to be the general morale? I mean, you interviewed a few people for this piece, but all things considered, do they have pretty positive attitudes about their situation? I mean, most of us live paycheck to paycheck, but do they have a pretty positive outlook on things, or does it seem like a really desperate situation?
I mean, they knew what they were getting into. So no one joins legal aid thinking they're going to be making a lot of money. So it's no surprise that they're going to be struggling financially for as long as they work there, which I think is why their morale is still pretty solid.
What is being done? Like you mentioned Kamala Harris, who's running for the Democratic nomination, who really has committed not only speech, but trying to work on some kind of policy in order for legal aid attorneys to get paid more. But what is happening? How is either city governments or other folks in general responding to this crisis? Is there movement? Are you hopeful that this will change?
So recently, Bill de Blasio, he said that he was committed to solving the pay parity issue by 2024, I think. But when I was talking with the union rep, the union president, he said they still are trying to analyze what pay parity means, which confused me because I thought that was pretty much an obvious blanket term for equal pay.
Has the mayor released his budget yet there in New York City in terms of when will we know whether or not he provides funding for the situation?
So I actually thought it was much sooner than it will be. The union president, he told me that'll be in March, probably. So that's a substantially long time from now.
Yeah.
But again, like when they ask for $50 million, that's not just for legal aid. That's for all the other legal services in New York.
Okay.
So they're not sure how much they're going to be getting personally.
Yeah.
And even if they do get a fair amount, they still have to pay rent. They still have to pay utilities. They still have to hire experts. So all of these things that corporate counsel gets as being a government agency, legal aid is funding themselves.
Yeah. Tell you what. Well, hey, Sonia, thank you so much for taking a bit of time today to help us make sense of this issue. We're definitely going to keep watching there in New York City to find out what happens with Mayor de Blasio's budget, but we're also going to be much more attentive to what's happening in our own cities as it relates to public defenders and legal aid. So, listeners, again, this has been freelance writer Sonia Weiser. Check her out on Twitter at Wise Choice, WEIS Choice. Sonia, take care. Please be well.
Thank you so much.
Bye-bye.
Thanks, Sonia. Bye-bye.
Bye.
All right, so thanks to today's guest, two really wonderful conversations. One, a lengthy conversation about the beauty of aunts and aunties and aunts.
Yes, yes. Especially in light of that recent Twitter blow up and conversation around people being called auntie or designated auntie.
Yeah,
and
that
then,
was
like,
interesting.
Being like,
that's
nah,
a whole conversation.
No auntie.
Yeah, yeah. We gotta have a, yeah. Like, the fact that we were, it might be, do you think it's regional, Doc? Like the notion of, like the South and I don't know the Midwest, but definitely the South revering aunties. And maybe you think Northerners?
No. I think that Black families like across the nation, North and South, revere aunties and respect aunties, and aunties operate as, you know, second mothers or go to or confidant, just like we discussed in the interview. I just think that there are some Black women, they know that, and they themselves might revere other folk, and you know, just don't call me that. Yeah.
I get that.
Yeah,
like,
so I get it.
Somebody was like, hey, Mr. Gardner. Yeah. Well, those high school students from St. Francis, I'm like, don't call me Mr. Gardner. Call me
people will call my dad since he's moved to Louisville, you know, after his retirement. People will say, hey, Mr. Ralph, stuff like that. Like,
yeah, I know. I used to call your dad. Listen, y'all.
Yeah.
One time, Doc's dad got with me. And as soon as they hurt my feelings when I get it, you know, because, you know, well, let's set it up. Initially, your parents are always like, hi, I'm Ralph and I'm Sylvia.
Yes.
Right? They're not Kyla's parents.
No.
They're Ralph and Sylvia.
Yes.
Of course, I can't call your dad Ralph. Can't call your mama Sylvia.
Yes.
So the default is, hey, Miss Sylvia.
Yes.
Hey, you know, I used to call your mom actually Business Story. I used to send her cards. Like, she's like, my last name is Rogers. But I saw,
she's
you know,
like, I changed it after
so
the divorce.
So of course, I'm like, hey, Miss Sylvia. Hey, Mr. Ralph.
Yes.
Right? So like this went on, y'all, for probably a good 6 years. Like, listen, Doc Story,
and my
he's
mom,
cool.
My mom got used to it because she moved from Michigan to Illinois and then South Carolina, and so everyone at her job would call her Miss Sylvia as well.
So she
and,
was used
you
to
know,
that.
But she still hates it
but
as
like
well.
But like 6 years into it, your dad was like, Why does, because I used to call you Doc. I always called you Doc. For a long time, I called you Doc. Now I call you Kyla Magic or whatever. Yeah. But your dad was like, well, why does he call you Dr. Story and call you Mr. Ralph? I was a doctor first. And so you were like, ooh, Jay, call my dad Doc Story.
Yeah.
And so I'm like, yeah, but I get it. And I get that, again, it doesn't matter if it makes sense to the person, but it makes sense, like, people, I get that. Like, don't call me Mr. Gardner. You know, it's cute. I get that it's respectful, but I feel like I'm still Jason, right?
And
I mean,
I really can't stand nobody calling me
Miss Kyla. You don't want to be called Miss Story.
Oh, no,
Mrs. Story.
I don't want to be called Miss Kyla. I don't want to be called Mrs. Story Jack. I mean, I'll be called Mrs. Story Jackson, right? But if I'm in a work environment or I'm doing a public speech, Dr. Story is fine.
Dr. Story is fine.
Yeah. And so, it's easier to pronounce for people. So people,
I love you say that.
You know I make it on my Facebook status. And I mean, it is, because it's true. It's like I get tired of folks. Again, my name is clearly says that it's Kyla, right? In any other case, it's Kyla. But because people are so scared to mispronounce it, they inevitably end up mispronouncing it. So they'll be like, hey, Kayla. Hey, Kyla. Hey, Koji Jakalia. Yeah. It's like, girl, you know what? You I got a doctorate. You can just say Dr. Story. You get confused. You get anxiety. And you get confused. You can always just call me Dr. Story.
Oop, there you go.
You know, child,
I love it.
But I don't have a problem either.
Nieces and stuff, they call you Auntie Kyla, and that does not offend you at all.
No. And I mean, even if it was folks outside of, like, my family calling me, like, oh, Auntie Kyla or something like that, just as long as they pronounce Kyla, I'm fine.
Yeah.
You can call me anything you want, just to get it correct.
I was thinking, like, I was thinking about the fact that you're already 40. Are you 40 yet?
No.
Okay, you're almost 40, but you'll be 40 before me.
I'll be 40 in January.
Yeah, you'll be 40 long before me.
Yeah, but I was thinking, it's only 6 months.
As we approach this older age, Doc, we really are, like, I was thinking about this, like, we're about to be elders for real, to some degree, in the LGBTQ community.
Yeah.
And I was like, and I'm finally at a place in my life where I'm kind of, like, resting in that, like, being okay with that, as I get the gray hair and I pick up more weight. Like,
I love as you get the gray hair. You have that gray hair for years.
Oh, excuse me. excuse me, ma'am.
But it's distinguished.
Excuse me, the story.
First of all, it's distinguished.
Thank you. As I've been comfortable with it, like, I'm okay with being, like, one day they being like, oh, that's, I don't know what they would call it. It'd be like Mr. IQ or Mr.
No,
J.
they
like,
would call you Uncle IQ.
Yeah, but I kind of, like, look forward to being.
Or Unc is cute.
Oh, yeah, to being an old elder. You know, because I think about, like, I don't know a lot of old LGBT people, like, who are, like, 60, 70, 80, 90 years old. And I look forward to being that and being revered and treated with a certain tenderness and reverence by your community. I don't know. Like, people
I do
this
too.
Major.
I do, too. But I also believe in. You know, if Ava said, look, don't call me auntie, I ain't calling her.
Yeah,
so I believe in people choosing labels that they want projected on them or not. But I love aunties, and I love the reverence that Black community pays to aunties. They're so important to Integral. So, yeah.
Absolutely. So thanks to Brandon T. Harden for that wonderful piece. Thank you to Sonia Weiser for the quick check-in about attorneys and how they own child. This is a struggle for everybody in these streets, honey. It's a struggle.
I know.
I mean, you got attorneys.
Well, I mean,
they said something about $200,000 in debt.
I think that it's a common thing. What, no matter what the job, no matter what the degree, people are out here struggling financially, and so people's jobs and finances are just not cutting it for all the debt that they're in, and all of the expenses that they have for their families in their day to day. So. I hope that it really, really changes for public defenders, as I hope it changes for everybody who has to work, you know, 2 and 3 jobs. That, I mean, one, you're dealing with sleep deprivation.
Yeah.
And then two, you're still working 2 or 3 jobs just to still be broke. I feel like that is inhumane.
Yeah.
It's inhumane. Yeah. And I'm just, you know, I mean, I wish I would be driving to one job half sleep and still not afford nothing.
Yeah.
I mean, that's what people are. I mean,
still
that's the reality.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's a common reality throughout the United States, no matter what the region, no matter inflation, no matter cost of living. People are out here struggling.
Yeah. The last thing I want to say, Doc, we had a really wonderful event this week that I moderated. You came and supported me.
It was wonderful.
The public library here in Louisville about queer spaces and places throughout time. We had a wonderful panel featuring.
And we had David Williams, who's a former guest and friend of the show. And I love that he was talking about the former gay bars and talked about the Queen Bee, honey.
Yeah, oh yeah, because he talked about
the lesbian bars.
Yeah. You love the Queen Bee.
I love the Queen Bee. I love that name.
Yes.
And what was the other names of the...
That was the Motherboard or something, or the Mothership.
That I didn't appreciate that.
You don't like the ones that have innuendos of women's body parts.
No, yeah. I think we're over that time period. Yeah. I feel like it's past. I get the whole lesbian feminist impulse to do that and reclaim those body parts. But I think that we're in a different space now. And I would rather a catchy name for a lesbian dive bar or
the
labia. Like, I'm tired of that. You know, and I feel like it's something that I've seen throughout places I've lived where it seems to only be like lesbian spots that tend to do this with the body parts. Uh-huh. And don't get more clever names and stuff like that. But I did appreciate the Queen Bee. And I love to hear old-fashioned names of spots in which, you know, we met up.
Yeah.
You know,
so the Penguins, by the way, were David Williams, who's an archivist and historian. He's been on our show before. Of course, Victoria Simone Taylor, who's been on our show a couple times. And then our new friend, Mickey Schickel Nelson, who is a lesbian, but who was around for the very early parts of the Gay Liberation Front. And then she had some really interesting stories to tell, too. So that was a really cool event. So shout out to all the people at the library for that wonderful event. And yeah, I guess that's it for now, huh?
Yeah.
All right, well, we're out of time. We'll be back next week. Doc, say goodbye.
Bye.
Bye, everybody.
Strange Fruit is produced by Louisville Public Media. Our engineer is Kojin Toshiro.
For more information about Strange Fruit, visit strangefruitpod.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter at Strange Fruit Pod.
The views expressed on Strange Fruit do not reflect those of Louisville Public Media, its staff, or its underwriters.
Strange Fruit is produced by me, Kyla Story.
And me, Jason Gardner.
Thanks for listening.
From Louisville Public Media.
Support for LPM Podcasts comes from the Eye Care Institute and Butchertown Clinical Trials, where they strive for diversity, equity, and inclusion within their staff, patients, and clinical trial participants. To learn more, visit butchertown.clinic.